I passed with a 94. My test and score are right there in the scrapbook labeled 1973. Ernie, a month older, had also passed on his birthday, and his parents had surprised him with a tomato red Volkswagen Beetle. I had my hopes up that my parents would do the same, though I knew money continued to be tight for my father.
"I don't think he's chewing," my father said. "I think he's inhaling."
"Just hungry," I said. "Well, even hungry people can have manners, Samuel," my mother said. "Don't talk with your mouth full." Half an hour into the meal, I pushed my plate aside. "I'm stuffed."
"You haven't finished your baked potato," my father said. "That isn't like you."
It wasn't like me. My mother liked to tell everyone that I was eating her out of house and home. I wasn't big, like Ernie, who had shot up to 6'3" and more than 200 pounds of lean muscle. But I had grown to nearly 5'9" and 140 pounds, with the metabolism of a jackrabbit. "I'm saving room for cake," I said, which awaited us at the house, along with, I hoped, that car I wanted. 5. My heart sank when my father pulled the Falcon into the driveway. No car blocked our path. I told myself I had no one to blame but myself. I had allowed myself to get my hopes up, and I, of all people, should have known better. My father was working even longer hours at the store, and a new car was simply not realistic. I appreciated that. Certainly I did. But I was 16, with a new driver's license burning a hole in my wallet. I pushed out of the back seat and slowly made my way up the walk.
"All night you've been giving us the bum's rush, and now we finally get home and you're as slow as molasses in the dead of winter," my mother said.
As my father opened the front door, he turned to my mom. "I think I left my reading glasses in the car," he said, and stepped as if to get past me. Then he pivoted and gently pushed me into the house.
"Surprise!"
The light burst on. Ernie, Mickey, and about half a dozen of our high school classmates from St. Joe's crowded into the hallway, along with Mr. and Mrs. Cantwell.
"Now do you see why I was eating so slowly?" my mother asked. "You almost ruined your surprise."
The surprise party, I would learn, had been Mickey's idea, and she had leaned heavily on Ernie to get some of my classmates to attend. At the dining room table, my mother and Mickey embarrassed me by insisting that I wear a pointed party hat, something my friends also encouraged. The photographs are also in the scrapbook, and, ironically, everyone in them has red eyes from the flash of the bulb. After I blew out the candles, my mother cut and served the cake while I opened presents. Ernie handed me a card. "This is from all of us." 7 guys, 1 card. "That sounds about right," I said. Glued to the inside of the card was a brown paper bag with 6 $5 bills.
"Jensen still needs to pony up," Ernie said.
Rich Jensen, the center on our basketball team, was a notorious cheapskate. I didn't expect I would see his $5. The Cantwells handed me a wrapped box, which my mother said was unnecessary, but thoughtful. I unwrapped it and found a baseball autographed by none other than the great Willie Mays, encased in a clear plastic, like a priceless jewel.
"No way," I said,
turning the case over and considering the signature from every angle.
"How did you get it?"
Mr. Cantwell shrugged. I knew his business was doing well, because he had moved out of the garage to a high-rise office building, and, of course, he'd bought Ernie the car. My mother sent us downstairs to the basement, which they had converted to a teen hangout. My father had put in a television, pool table, dartboard, and pinball machine, all of which he'd obtained from the owner of a bar on Broadway that went out of business. Mickey ran the pool table like a hustler. No one could beat her, though it didn't stop my friends from trying. They were clearly more interested in watching her, and with good reason. I had been shocked the prior summer when Mickey had accompanied my family to the Russian River and wore a bikini. She had a lean, athletic build with a tiny waist, rock-hard abs, and a butt my classmates joked could be used to snap off a bottle cap on a beer. They were enjoying watching her chalk the cue and bend over the table, something Mickey did with dripping sexuality. Everything she did
Drip's sexuality. It was apparent to me she was enjoying the attention.
Don't you think you should give someone else a chance? I whispered.
I would if someone could step up and beat me, she said. I thought St. Joe's was a jock school.
This only led to further challenges. Shortly after midnight, my classmates departed, though not before three offered to drive Mickey home. She declined and sat on the sofa between me and Ernie, her head on my shoulder, as we watched a late-night movie.
Mickey, I better get you home,
my father said, descending the stairs. Then he stopped.
What am I saying? Sam, you have a license now. Why don't you drive Mickey home?
We made our way upstairs to the kitchen, where my mother was finishing the dishes. I hugged her from behind. Thanks for the great birthday, Mom. I felt guilty about wanting a car, knowing how hard my father was working to make ends meet.
Did you get everything you wanted? She asked.
Even more, I said.
Driving is a big responsibility.
You be careful and come right home. I promised I would.
And do not sit parked in the car, she said, giving me a knowing look.
Mom. Mickey had entered the kitchen.
Don't worry, Mrs. H. I won't let him try any funny business.
I know you won't, Michaela, because you are a young lady. My mother was the only person who could get away with using Mickey's full name.
Okay, I said, feeling my face flush. We're out of here.
My dad handed me the keys to the Falcon. I opened the front door for Mickey, but when I followed her onto the porch, I bumped into her. She'd stopped suddenly.
No way,
Mickey said, looking and sounding dumbfounded. The Falcon remained parked in the driveway, but was now wrapped in a big red bow. I turned to my parents.
Surprise,
my mother and father said in unison.
No way, no way,
Mickey said, stepping from the porch to the driveway, circling the car.
You caught the Falcon?
Damn, Ernie said under his breath. I'd expected a junker, something slow and safe, if anything at all. The Falcon was cool in and of itself. Forget that it was also a convertible and fast.
Really? I asked.
My dad shrugged. Your mother wants a new car. But I knew my mother still loved that Falcon, even if it now had some miles on it and tended to leak a little oil.
It's mine? I asked,
still not believing. If you pay for your own gas and upkeep, my father said. I had grown up spending Sunday afternoons changing the oil and doing the tune-ups on the cars with my dad. I don't know if he did it to avoid Fast Eddie's garage or to save money, or both. But I had learned a lot, and I knew I could keep the Falcon running in tip-top shape. Paying for gas, however, would not be easy. My friend's $30 wouldn't go far with gas at 36 cents a gallon.
You'll be a chick magnet driving that car, hell, Ernie said, especially with me in the passenger seat.
You got a car, Mickey said, not sounding at all happy at my second surprise of the night.
I'm talking Friday and Saturday nights, Ernie said. Cruising the El Camino Real.
We'll wait a bit for that, my mom said, arching her eyebrows at Ernie. Samuel just got his license.
I'll watch out for him, Mickey said, and make sure no chicks stick to the car.
6. As we drove the El Camino, Mickey slid across the bench seat and pressed next to me. This would become her unwavering spot.
You are so spoiled, she said.
I'm not spoiled, I said, but I was unable to hide the huge grin carved across my face.
They gave you a freaking car.
It's not exactly new, and I have to pay for my own gas and upkeep. You heard my dad.
Poor baby.
If anyone is spoiled, it's Ernie. He got a new car.
Please, a convertible Falcon or a VW Bug? Kids would kill to have this car. You might even get laid, Hill.
I felt my face flush. Mickey leaned away, smiling.
Don't tell me you're still a virgin, Hill.
No, I said. But I was never a good liar, especially not with Mickey.
You are, she said, smiling. You're still a virgin.
Okay, so I am. So what? A lot of guys my age are. That's because you go to us school without girls, and you're all homos, she said, teasing me. But I was in no mood to be teased.
No, it's because girls don't exactly swoon for guys with red eyes.
We sat in silence. At high school dances, there was never a shortage of girls who wanted to dance with the great Ernie Cantwell, and Mickey was surrounded like Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind. I usually held up a wall for a while, then found an excuse to leave. While it might have been Mickey's newly developed figure that drew the boys like flies to raw meat, I suspected it was also the reputation Mickey had developed since her expulsion from the Catholic girls' school. Ernie and I had heard guys talking about her and wanted to tell her, but we both lacked the courage to do so. For some reason, perhaps because I was hurt, I mustered the courage that night. Mickey said, "Sorry, Sam, I'm just teasing you." "You know, you've got to be careful, Mickey." She gave me a sidelong glance.
"About what?"
"Guys talk a lot."
"What?
That Catholic girls are all as horny as goats crap?" I'd heard the same thing, but in my limited experience, I certainly hadn't seen any evidence to support the proposition.
"Guys talk about you," I said.
She turned her shoulder away from me.
"I don't give a shit what they say."
"You should." She turned her head to me, defiant.
"Why?"
"Because they're saying things about you, that you put out and stuff.
Those assholes can say whatever they want. They don't know."
"Why didn't you let someone else play pool tonight?"
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"I don't know."
"Didn't you see them looking at you?"
"So what? Am I supposed to let them beat me because you don't like them checking out my ass?"
"I didn't say that."
"Then what?"
"Never mind. Let's just drop it."
"Why didn't you say something to them?"
"Because I'm not your boyfriend. You got that right."
We drove the El Camino in silence, both of us staring out the windshield. When I pulled up to her house and parked, Mickey turned to me.
"Sorry," she said. "I didn't mean to make you feel bad about being a virgin. I was just teasing you. It's kind of cute, actually."
"It's okay," I said, feeling like a puppy. "And I'm sorry about saying you should have let someone else play." She smiled, but it had a sad quality to it.
"I'll tell you what. If you're still a virgin when you turn 18, Hill, I'll sleep with you before you go off to college."
I tried to force a laugh, but it came out sounding like I was choking. Then I said,
"What, and spoil this beautiful thing we have going on?"
"What do we have going on?" I felt the temperature in the car drop again.
"What do you mean? We're friends."
"Yeah," she said, "we're friends."
"What's wrong? What did I say?"
"Never mind." Mickey slid across the seat and pushed out of the car door. I leaned across the red leather, speaking out the window when she closed the door.
"Hey, what's the matter with you?"
The small box hit me in the face and fell to the seat.
"Happy birthday," Mickey said.
And she ran up the driveway. Perplexed, I picked up the box and opened it. Inside, on a thin square of cotton, was a silver chain with a medal of St. Christopher, the patron saint of travelers. I turned over the silver disc. Even without the dome light, I could read what Mickey had inscribed. "To keep you safe, M." 7. In the spring of my sophomore year, I made the junior varsity baseball team. Despite my initial incompetence at three flies up, my mother's willingness to spend her Saturdays hitting me ground balls and pitching to me had helped me develop into a decent singles hitter and fair defender. But by mid-season, I'd suddenly begun to strike out frequently.
"What do you think it could be?"
my father asked over dinner one evening. Frustrated, I said, "I don't know. It's like I'm not seeing the ball." My mother had me in Dr. Pridemore's office the very next day. After an eye exam, Dr. Pridmore delivered his clinical diagnosis. You are not seeing the ball. Frankly, I can't figure out how you're seeing the chalkboard in class. Have you been experiencing headaches? I had, but I'd compensated by moving up a row in all my classes. Your vision is slipping, he said, which caused my mother to slip into full panic. How bad is it? She asked. Could he go blind? Dr. Pridmore assured her I was not going blind. But you do need glasses. I picked out sturdy black frames, like Clark Kent. They didn't do any wonders to improve my looks, which were average at best. My hair had darkened to a deeper shade of brown, my jaw had become squarer, and my forehead was broader. People said I looked like my father, and I saw the resemblance in pictures of him as a young man. As I wore the glasses, however, I noticed something I had not expected. The glasses seemed to soften my most obvious feature. Mickey, who was waiting at my house after my eye appointment, was gentle in her assessment. She called my new specs sexy, in a nerdy way. Ernie was more honest the next day at school. You look like Jerry Lewis in The Nutty Professor, he said. 8. Junior year, I'd survived the first round of roster cuts for the varsity basketball team, a heartless practice in which Coach Moran pinned the names of players still on the team to a corkboard outside his office. My name was second from the bottom, but I suspected my time on that list was growing short. 13 players remained for 12 spots. Coach said he'd tell the final cut personally. When a student entered my fourth period pre-calculus class carrying a pink slip and my teacher looked in my direction, I wasn't completely caught off guard. Hell, he said, using my nickname, which had become common even among the teachers. Coach Moran wants to see you in his office after class. Coach Moran didn't send pink slips to be chummy. I was about to become one of the nerds, and possibly one of the dorks. I would no longer be one of the jocks. To say that St. Joseph's locker room badly needed renovating was like saying the Watergate scandal had been a minor breaking and entering. Untouched since the school opened in the 1940s, the room had cement walls, narrow, mesh-covered windows, and the lighting, ventilation, and ambiance of a Turkish prison. The metal locker smelled like rotting fruit. Coach Moran's cramped office was in the corner of this mess, and I wondered whether the sour atmosphere contributed to his seemingly perpetual sour demeanor. I pushed my glasses onto the bridge of my nose and knocked. Coach Moran yelled, "Enter!" And I pushed the door open. "You wanted to see me, Coach?" Coach put a hand over the telephone receiver, which he was holding to his ear. "Come in and sit down, Hal," he said in a hushed tone. I sat in a folding chair beside several desks, one of which doubled as the trainer's table. I assumed Coach Moran was talking to his wife, since he sounded politer than I'd ever heard him and didn't drop a single swear word during the two-minute conversation. "He's the best athlete I've seen," I heard Coach say, "and he's just a junior." He paused. "That's because the Times didn't cover us much last year, but trust me, you'll want to see this kid play." I knew the kid had to be Ernie, who'd made the varsity football and basketball teams as just a sophomore and was their best player. "That's why I'm calling. I thought maybe you could get a foot in the door before the wolves descend. And believe me, they'll devour this kid. At the moment, he's flying under the radar, but that's going to change soon." After another minute, Coach replaced the receiver and leaned back in his chair. The most valuable player on his high school football, basketball, and baseball teams, Coach Moran had his name stitched in gold letters on 3 navy blue blankets hanging from the St. Joe's basketball gym rafters. Lean and muscular, Coach still looked like he could go out and dominate in any of those sports. "What am I going to do with you, Sam Hell?" He had a habit of saying a player's first and last names when imparting instruction or criticism. "We can't have that, Sam Hell. No, we can't. You have to set that screen right there, Sam Hell. You don't, and we're fucked. You understand me, Sam Hell?" "Yes, Coach." "Then set the goddamn screen, Sam Hell." I knew Coach's question was rhetorical, but I saw it as a chance to lobby for myself. "Put me on the team, Coach?" He chuckled at my boldness. "Hell, you have the heart of a lion. I'll give you that. I've never had a more determined son of a bitch play for me. All you're lacking to be a good basketball player is height, quickness, and shooting ability. You're too short, too slow, and can't shoot.
I can learn to shoot, I said.
His smile waned. He lowered the front legs of his chair to the ground. I have a hard decision to make, Hal. I have to choose between you and Chuck Bennett. And I only have 12 uniforms. Let me be straight with you. You'd be the 12th man, which means you'd practice, but rarely play. I have no doubt you'd practice hard, work your ass off, but...
He paused, looking at his hands folded in his lap. Here's the thing, Hal. Mr. Shubb says you're a hell of a writer, that you got real talent.
I failed to see the connection. Dick Shubb was the moderator of the St. Joe's Friar, the school newspaper.
He wants you on his staff, but the staff meetings are after school, as is most of the production time.
Now I saw the connection.
You couldn't do both, Hal.
Coach ran a hand over his chin as if considering whether to shave.
Bennett, on the other hand, is a first-class fuck-up. I cut him, and he'll end up in the pit smoking pot with the stoners. So you see the problem I have, Hal?
I did, of course. But facing the prospect of losing one of my dreams, being benevolent wasn't my priority.
Then Coach asked,
What do you want to be, Hal? You have any idea?
I was thinking maybe a doctor, I said. Maybe an ophthalmologist.
The idea had come to me one day while Dr. Pridmore examined my eyes. Dr. Pridmore had always taken the time to explain to me not only my condition, but the inner workings of the eye. It seemed like a natural fit.
What do you think will benefit you most in the future, on your resume? The ability to write, or to shoot a free throw?
Coach was right. We both knew it. Looking back, it was the most candid advice from the most unlikely source, and it changed my life in many ways. But goddamn, I wanted to play basketball and still be a jock, even if it was in name only. Then another idea hit me, and I quickly realized I could make this a win-win situation for me and for Ernie. I did love to write, and the newspaper would be a way for me to pad my resume. And if the plan I was formulating worked out, I could also make some money for my college tuition. As for Ernie, while he excelled on the athletic fields, he continued to struggle in the classroom, despite my tutelage. Ernie's grades could limit his choices of colleges, unless he could get an athletic scholarship. That required notoriety, and Coach Moran was right. The local paper did a poor job covering high school sports.
Coach, if it's all the same to you,
I think I'm going to join the newspaper staff, I said. I appreciate the spot, but my dad also needs a delivery boy at his store after school, and I don't see how I could do it all.
We stood and we shook hands. Your name will be on the list I post this afternoon, Hal. You can bet your ass it will. I'll leave it up to you what you want to tell everyone.
I reached the door.
Hal.
Yeah, Coach?
Life is about heart. Yours is as big as any kids I've ever coached. Don't you forget that.
No, Coach. I won't. I left his office with one less dream, but somehow feeling like I was 7 feet tall.
9. What happened?
Ernie asked the question even before the swinging door to the locker room had shut behind me. He'd been waiting in the hall.
I made the team, I said.
He pumped his fist as we walked through a hall crowded with students coming back from lunch and hurrying to get to class.
I knew he'd keep you. You work harder than anyone.
I turned him down.
Ernie stopped. You did what?
Mr. Shubb is looking for someone to write sports for the newspaper and take over as the editor-in-chief next year.
So?
The first bell clattered, echoing loudly. I think I'll get more out of that than playing sports. It's a big commitment. I can't do both. Plus, my dad needs me at the store.
You're giving up basketball?
It's better for my future, I said over the clatter of the bell and the banging of lockers.
You can't quit, Sam.
I'm not quitting, I said. I'm just choosing something different. Besides, think about all the great stories I can write about you now.
This caught Ernie's interest. His eyes widened. I'm going to call up the Times and get a job covering high school games. Coach says they don't have a high school reporter. When I'm done, you'll be a legend.
The idea to contact the Times had come from my eavesdropping on Coach Moran's telephone conversation. If I was going to be writing articles for the school paper, I might as well see if I could get paid to do it. I called the Times sports editor when I got home and asked if he wanted a high school reporter. He asked me to see him the following day and to bring examples of my writing, which were essays I'd written in my English classes since I hadn't yet written for the paper. Given that saying about beggars not being choosy, the Times hired me. They agreed to pay me 35 cents a column inch, plus my mileage to and from games. They also gave me a press pass. My coverage of Ernie's exploits appeared in the Times at least once a week during the next year and a half. By our senior year, I hadn't just made Ernie a legend at St. Joe's. I'd made him a household name throughout the county. College recruiters showed up in hordes at Ernie's games and practices. The recruiting letters, which started as a trickle, became a deluge of envelopes stuffing his parents' mailbox and bore the insignias for USC, UCLA, California, Syracuse, North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, and Arizona. Coaches offered him scholarships in basketball, football, and track. But it became apparent that football was the sport that best utilized all of Ernie's athleticism and provided his best chance at a professional career. Giving up basketball for the journalism staff had two other unintended consequences. After a feature article I wrote about Ernie won first place in a journalism contest and I received a $500 scholarship, Mr. Shubb entered my writing in other competitions. By the end of my senior year, I had won close to $2,500 in scholarship money, which, as my mother liked to say, was no small potatoes. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Not playing sports also gave me the time to work at my father's store, and that led to a second unintended consequence. I wouldn't need to take Mickey up on her offer when I turned 18. 10. My father's disappointment that I would no longer be playing competitive sports was tempered when I told him that night at the dinner table that I wanted to earn money working at his store and could save for college. I knew my parents were concerned about the expense. More than once, my mother had intimated that the community college would be a great way to get my general education requirements out of the way. She was right, I knew, and I didn't want to tax their budget any more than I already was, but I also really wanted to go to college. As of tomorrow, you are Broadway Pharmacy's part-time delivery and stock boy, and when Alex leaves for college next year, you can take on the extra days.
Only if he keeps his grades up, my mother said. She expressed no disappointment at the end of my competitive athletic career.
As she spooned mashed potatoes onto my plate, she said, "Maybe you'll become the next Woodward and Bernstein. Or Walter Cronkite. Wouldn't that be something, Sam?" I agreed it would be, but I doubted anyone would want to hire a newscaster with red eyes. Much as I had come to accept my appearance, I was not so naive as to believe people would readily accept me. Someone who looked so different, and there was never a shortage of people to remind me of this when I grew too comfortable. 11.
The St. Joe's newspaper was produced every other week, with production taking place right after class. I could work the schedule so I could be at my dad's store in time to dust mop the floor, stock the shelves, and get out the door to make the deliveries. Shortly after the Easter holiday, I entered the pharmacy to find a new girl being trained at the front register by my dad's longtime assistant, Betty. Some months earlier, my father told us at dinner that Betty had asked to cut back on her hours. Her husband had taken sick. My mom suggested that my dad hire girls from the local high school to work part-time for minimum wage. The girl behind the counter looked up from Betty's tutelage and smiled without hesitation.
"You must be Sam."
She stuck her hand across the counter. "I'm Donna." My mother would have called Donna Husky.
The blue smock did not hang on her the way it did on Betty. It protruded over her chest. I suspected Donna was stacked.
"Hi," was all I could manage.
I set about my business, but found mopping the floor more difficult than usual. It seemed no matter the aisle I moved to, Donna would appear to dust the merchandise and talk to me in between waiting on customers.
"Your father says you go to St. Joe's."
She flipped her hair from her shoulder and folded it behind her ear, revealing a silver hoop earring. Blue eyeshadow painted her upper eyelids.
"I'm a junior," I said.
"I'm a senior at Burlingame. What's it like going to school without any girls?"
"It's okay," I said. "You get used to it."
"I'd think an all-girls school would be boring," she said. "I can't imagine going to one. It seems like my best friends are always guys."
"Your dad says you play baseball."
"I play first base on the softball team."
"I had to give it up to write for the newspaper," I said, which was an outright lie, since I hadn't gone out for the team.
"I know," she said. "I saw your stories in the window."
My father displayed all my articles from the Friar and the Times in the store windows with great pride.
"I like the one you did about Ernie Cantwell hitting the last second shot. You really made it sound exciting."
"You read my articles?"
"Not all of them, but the ones I've read are really good."
She was being kind. The Times edited my sports story so much it was like that one line on the TV show Dragnet. "Just the facts." Still, it felt cool to have a senior girl tell me she liked my stories.
"Maybe I'll come watch you play softball sometime," I said. "Maybe I could write an article for the Times."
I was hoping to impress her. The Times would never cover girl softball.
"That would be great," she said, "though I don't think you'd have much to write about."
I had never felt comfortable talking to girls, except for Mickey, of course, who was at my house even more than in grammar school. She and my mother continued to spend time together even when I wasn't home. They would shop together and occasionally go to the movies. Every so often I'd catch them alone at the kitchen table, and Mickey would look like she'd been crying. But when I asked about it, my mother's response remained consistent.
"Girl stuff. It wouldn't interest you."
Mickey gave me the same mantra. Talking with Donna was easy. I felt no pressure and no reason to be self-conscious. She was 18 and a senior, after all. She had no interest in someone barely 17 years old. I seemed to have an inordinate number of deliveries that afternoon and didn't make it back to the store until 5 minutes before closing. After ringing up the cash purchases, I hurried to the back room to grab my coat. Donna was standing on her toes, reaching to hang up her smock. My assessment had been correct. A white knit sweater did nothing to camouflage the size of her breasts. She turned her head, catching me looking. Trying to cover, I stepped toward her.
"You need any help?"
"I'm short, but not that short."
"Thanks."
"Wow, polite and cute." I felt my face flush and turned to grab my jacket from the hook behind the door.
"Well, I'll see you tomorrow," I said.
"Wednesday," she said. "My parents don't want me working every day. I have to keep my grades up. I've got a full load this semester, and I partied a bit too much last semester."
"Okay, Wednesday," I said.
I knew Donna was just being courteous when she called me cute. I was, after all, the boss's son. Besides, it had sounded like something a big sister would tell her little brother. Still, I found myself thinking of her that night as I studied in my room. And during the next 2 days. 12. I arrived late to the store Wednesday after a journalism meeting went longer than expected, and I had just enough time to get out a quick hello to Donna as I raced past the front counter and pushed through the swinging door to the elevated pharmacy. My father stood at the counter, hunting and pecking at the typewriter with two fingers.
"Sorry I'm late, Dad.
School comes first."
He ripped off a label and handed it to his tech.
"I'll catch up."
I grabbed the dust mop and started down the aisles. Donna remained behind the counter, talking with Leo Tamaro. Tamaro had been a football player of some repute at the local high school, but I'd heard he was also dumb as a post. Tamaro liked to come into the store to talk sports with my dad, and I'd recently heard him say he'd taken some time off from college.
Tamaro talked with Donna the entire time it took me to dust mop, and he remained at the counter when I went to empty the garbage beneath the front register.
"Hey, sport," he said, making me feel like I was 10. "Your dad says you're a big-time sports reporter now, huh? You know what they say, those who can, do. Those who can't, write about those who can."
He gave Donna a toothy grin. "I think the saying is, those who can, do. Those who can't, don't," I said.
"Yeah, whatever."
"How's community college?" I asked.
"I'm taking a break," he said. "I had a business opportunity come up, and I didn't want to pass it up."
He turned and pointed out the window to an older model red Camaro parked at the curb.
"Check out the new wheels. Cost me nearly a grand."
"Nice," I said. And then, because I just couldn't help myself, "Camaro's Camaro." Donna snorted, then tried to cover it up as a sneeze.
Camaro said, "Yeah, I'm thinking about getting one of those personalized license plates."
Donna's lips were pursed tight, as if she was holding her breath. I indicated I needed to get the garbage below the cash register, and she took a step back to give me room. I knelt, biting my tongue to keep from laughing, and pulled out the box of garbage, which was filled with Kleenex. Betty had a perpetual cold, along with candy wrappers and receipts. When I reached behind the box to gather all of Betty's frequent misses, Donna bent down behind the register. The blue smock, which she left mostly unzipped, fell open, revealing a silver chain with a locket and a considerable line of freckled cleavage. I tried to keep my eyes focused on the garbage, but then she said, "Here you go, Sam." She handed me a balled-up scrap of paper and mimed sticking her finger down her throat. I laughed out loud. At that point, I think even Tamaro realized he'd been the butt of my joke. When I popped back up, he said,
"So, are you in high school yet, sport?"
"I'm a junior," I said.
"At St. Mo's?"
He said this in a feminine voice and bent his wrist.
"I couldn't do a school without the ladies. I guess you don't have that problem. Or maybe you do."
He bent his wrist again. My father called from the back of the store, indicating Tamaro's prescription had been filled.
"Get that for me, will you, sport? You're the delivery boy, after all, aren't you?"
He winked at Donna.
"No problem," I said.
I hurried like an obedient retriever, grabbed the white bag from the counter, and brought it back, handing Donna the paperwork to ring up the sale on the cash register. Tamaro pulled out a credit card and slapped it on the counter.
"You keep working hard, and someday you might get some plastic."
"Oh, yeah," I said, as if I'd forgotten. "My dad said to just rub that cream in twice a day, and it should take care of that rash in no time." My father had said no such thing and would never have broken a customer's confidence. But having been at the store, I'd picked up a bit about certain medications. Before Tamaro could respond, I nodded to the window. A parking meter cop stood on the sidewalk, flipping open her ticket book.
"I guess the parking meters don't take plastic."
Tamaro grabbed his package and hurried out, but not before Donna burst out laughing. 13. I returned from my deliveries just before my dad locked the front door and flipped the sign in the window to closed. Donna had stayed to help ring up the cash deliveries. Half an hour later, we all departed together.
"See you at home," my father said, walking to his car.
"Could you believe that guy today?" Donna asked as we walked down the sidewalk. "He hits on all the girls who work for my dad," I said, though Donna was the first girl to work at the store.
"Trust me, I know. He hit on all the girls at school, too. Everyone knows he's after one thing."
"Stimulating conversation?" I asked. Donna laughed.
"You're funny."
I stopped next to the Falcon, and she said,
"Now that is a sweet ride."
I mimicked the sound of Tamaro's voice.
"So, where are your wheels, sport?"
"No wheels for me, sport. My dad grounded me. Long story."
"Is someone picking you up?"
"Fat chance. When I'm grounded, I'm walking. It's my dad's way of punishing me. He says that maybe the exercise will clear my brain."
"Where do you live?"
"It's not far. I live in Hillsboro, just a couple of miles." Without thinking, I said, I'll give you a ride. You're sure it's not out of your way?
It was the opposite direction.
No problem at all.
Donna touched my arm, and it sent an electric pulse across my skin.
Like I said, polite and cute.
Inside the Falcon, Donna asked, can we put the top down? Though it was a bit chilly, I happily obliged. Other than Mickey and my mom, I'd never been alone in the Falcon with a girl. I hoped someone I knew would drive up and see me, the Devil Boy, with a high school senior riding in my car. Hillsboro was a wealthy neighborhood with large homes, sweeping driveways, and expansive lawns. We made several turns, and I knew I'd be hopelessly lost trying to get back home.
Turn here, Donna said.
I drove between two brick pillars leading to a driveway that curved past a manicured garden with English hedges, rose bushes, and other plants I couldn't name. I stopped the car beneath an impressive colonnade for a two-story stucco home.
What does your father do?
You mean when he's not on my case or grounding me? He's a big-shot lawyer.
What about your mom?
She pretty much plays golf and cards at the country club all day. At night, she drinks.
That statement hit me like a slap. I didn't know what to say.
Donna flipped her hair. Do you party, Sam?
I hadn't even had a beer up to that point.
When I can, was all I could muster.
It's such a double standard. My mom is shit-faced half the time, and if I party, my father grounds me. How is that fair?
I recognized her question to be rhetorical. Well, thanks for the ride, she said, and exited the car. But rather than run up the steps, Donna walked around to the driver's side and rested her forearms on the door. Her shirt fell open, and her cleavage swallowed the silver chain and metal.
Do you know how to get out of here?
I raised my eyes. Donna grinned.
You just take a right out of the driveway, turn left at the first stop sign, go one block, take another left, and follow the road back to the El Camino.
I nodded, but I doubted I would remember a single word. Then Donna leaned forward and kissed me hard on the mouth, her tongue forcing my lips apart, probing. Before I could even decide how to respond, she pulled back, smiling. Then she winked. See ya, sport. Struck dumb, I watched her bound up the steps and disappear through the front door. When I got home, my mother was finishing setting the table for dinner. She'd started to wait for me and my dad to get home so we could all eat together.
What took you? She asked.
I gave Donna a ride home. I quickly added, she didn't have a car and was going to have to walk. And it was getting dark.
That's nice.
He pulled open the fridge and retrieved the milk. Wash your hands. As I washed my hands at the bathroom sink, my mind drifted back to Donna's cleavage and her warm, moist lips pressed against mine, her tongue exploring.
Sam, food's on the table.
Feeling flush, I lowered my head and splashed water on my face.
Sam, I'll be out in a minute,
I said, using the hand towel to dry my face. I hoped it was a minute. I had my doubts. It had taken nearly the entire car ride home to lose my erection. 14. Donna did not work Thursday or Friday. I contemplated making some excuse to ask my father for her phone number, like she left something in my car. But the longer I chickened out, the less plausible that excuse became. Besides, I wasn't sure I'd be able to muster the courage to call her or to hold a conversation for very long. When Saturday finally arrived, I lay on the couch in the family room trying to act interested in a baseball game as I waited until Donna's shift began at noon. At 11:45, I was about to leave when I answered a knock at the front door. Mickey stepped past me into the family room.
Hey, where have you been? I called you last night.
I had an assignment for the Times, I said. I got home too late to call you back.
Since when?
Mickey and I often talked well into the night and early morning, though I had to initiate anything after 11 to keep my mother from answering the phone. I was tired. She sat in the chair and put her feet up on the ottoman.
Westworld is playing, she said.
Mickey liked movies that scared the shit out of her.
She looked to the television. Why are you watching UCLA? Isn't Stanford playing?
No, they're not televised, and I don't think I can go to the movies.
Why not?
I got stuff to do, I said.
She picked up the newspaper, flipping to the movie section.
Like what?
I have to study.
Come on, Hill. It's Saturday. You can't get any higher than an A+ in every class.
I was about to protest further when my mother walked in and brightened at the sight of Mickey. My mother's love for Mickey puzzled me. I was certain she knew Mickey wasn't exactly chaste, if not the full extent of Mickey's sexual exploits. And I couldn't think of anything short of a major crime, like murder, that would have made my mother more disappointed than to find out that her son was not a virgin, though I still very much remained one.
Hi, Mrs. H. I'm kidnapping Sam to the movies.
Good. He's been moping around here the past 2 days. Get him outside.
I haven't been... Have we been grumpy?
Mickey pinched my cheek.
Stop. Someone is grumpy.
Don't worry, Mrs. H. If I can't cheer him up, I'll slap the grumpy out of him.
Let's go, Hill. You heard your mother. Get your jacket and car keys. You can buy the tickets, since you're employed.
15. As we drove the El Camino with the top down, Mickey slid across the seat to her customary position next to me. I turned down Broadway.
It's at the Century Cinema, she said.
I want to take the freeway, and I need to stop and see my dad. Broadway bustled on Saturdays. People ran errands they couldn't get to during the week, or ate leisurely breakfast at one of the diners. I lucked out and found a parking space in front of my dad's store and searched the ashtray for change to pay the meter. When I looked up, I saw Donna at the counter, staring through the window at the tableau of Mickey sitting pressed beside me. I quickly opened the door and got out. I'll be back in a minute. I nearly closed the door on Mickey's leg.
Hold on!
She slid out.
What the hell, Hill? I want to get some candy for the movie and say hi to your dad.
Donna smiled when we entered. My father left the prescription room and walked down the aisle to greet us. Mickey gave him a hug.
Hey, Mr. H.
What are you two up to now? Do I dare ask?
We're going to the movies, she said. We're smuggling in candy.
I don't blame you, my dad said. Not with the prices they charge. Sam, did you introduce Mickey to Donna?
I turned, but before I could say anything, Donna had walked out from behind the counter.
What movie are you going to see?
Westworld, Mickey said.
I heard that's really scary. That's why I take Sam. He doesn't mind if I jump in his lap.
You don't jump in my...
When we saw the Poseidon Adventure, I practically shared his seat the whole movie.
That was like freshman year or something, I said. We're just friends. That went over like a lead balloon. My father and Mickey both looked puzzled. Donna just smiled. After the moment of silence, my dad said,
Donna, Mickey gets the family discount, 10% off.
He said goodbye and started back up the aisle.
Have fun at the movies.
Donna rang up Mickey's candy.
Anything else?
Don't look at me, Mickey said. My friend here is the one with the money. I paid for the candy, and Donna put it in a brown bag. I want a full report on the movie later, she called out as we were leaving, and for a moment, I felt that everything was okay. Then she added,
Sport.
When I opened the car door, Mickey stood waiting to slide in ahead of me. You better go around, I said. There's not much room. She looked at me like I'd gone crazy.
What are you talking about? There's plenty of room.
She squeezed past and slid onto the seat. I looked to the store window. Donna was waiting on a customer. When I slid in, Mickey was closer than ever.
Can you move over a bit? I said.
She looked annoyed. What's wrong with you?
There's nothing wrong with me. I don't want to get in an accident.
Your mother's right. You are grumpy.
Why? Because I don't want to get in an accident? You're practically driving the car.
Fine. She slid all the way to the passenger door.
Happy now?
As I backed out, I looked again to the store windows, but Donna was not at the counter.
Oh, Mickey said with a grin. Now I get it.
You got a thing for the girl with the big tits.
What?
Who? Donna? Please, she's 18.
You do.
That comment, we're just friends.
You have a crush on Betty Boobs.
I don't have a crush on her. I stepped down on the gas pedal too hard, causing the Falcon to shoot backward from the space. A car horn blared. Tires squealed. I hit the brakes, causing us to jerk to a stop. The bag of candy slid off the seat onto the floorboard. Mickey was laughing.
Why so nervous?
I'm not... I swore and waved an apology to the driver of the car I'd nearly hit. When he passed, I backed out more carefully.
Maybe your mind is on other things?
Will you just stop, I said, feeling myself getting more and more upset as we drove down Broadway toward the freeway.
Mickey said, I didn't take you for a guy that liked fat chicks.
I don't, she's not,
you're a tit man.
Can we just drop it, please?
What, are you afraid she'll think I'm your girlfriend?
I'm not afraid of anything. You're not my girlfriend.
You can bet your ass I'm not. I expect my boyfriends to treat me a hell of a lot better than you're treating me.
I'd lost it by this point.
What? Do you want me to unbutton your shirt and grab your tits, then not call you?
I regretted the words as they were leaving my mouth. And if I could have, I would have snatched them back.
Stop the car.
Mickey, I didn't mean it. She punched me on the arm.
Stop the fucking car or I swear to God I'll jump out.
She started to stand on the seat.
Okay, okay.
I turned the corner and pulled over. Mickey got out of the car and slammed the door shut behind her, storming down the sidewalk. I got out of the driver's seat and chased her down. When I caught up to her, I grabbed her arm, but she spun from my grasp and punched me in the chest.
Don't fucking touch me!
She hurried away from me. People now stood on the sidewalk, watching the two of us. I ran to catch up and lowered my voice.
Will you just stop? I'm sorry, okay? I'm sorry.
Mickey brooded and continued walking.
I'm sorry, I said for at least the fifth time.
She whirled on me.
How am I supposed to know you're having a wet dream over some fat girl?
A couple with a baby stroller slowed their approach, looking wary.
Will you stop yelling and just let me say something?
She crossed her arms.
Fine.
What? I waited for the couple to walk on.
I'm sorry. You said that.
Mickey started up the street, and I gave chase.
Wait.
What I mean is, I'm sorry that I didn't tell you. She stopped, hands on her hips.
Okay. Maybe I have a crush on her.
Then why didn't you just admit it?
Because she's 18. She's a senior. I'd look... You'd laugh at me.
She shook her head.
I'm not one of your stupid guy friends, Sam. I wouldn't laugh at you. But what you said really hurt me. I don't expect that from you.
I know, and I'm sorry. I'm an idiot.
You're not an idiot.
Sometimes you just act like one.
Is that what you think of me?
What? I asked.
That I let every guy grab me? You don't believe those morons, do you?
No, Mickey, I don't think anything. That's my problem. I don't think. She wiped her eyes, and I realized she was fighting back tears.
Because I don't, okay? I know what people say about me, but I'm not like that. Look, sometimes I just like to feel like...
She turned her head, but I saw a tear escape, rolling down her cheek.
My house... It's not great, Sam. My dad is working all the time, and he and my mother fight a lot when he's home. I usually have to take Joanna away,
she said, meaning her little sister, who was 8 years younger than Mickey.
And then I can't get my homework done. Her chest heaved. I'm failing two classes. It's a real mess.
I didn't know.
Of course you didn't know. You live with Ward and June Cleaver, for Christ's sake. Why do you think I'm always at your house? It's nice being someplace where people aren't yelling and screaming at each other all the time. How long has it been like this?
Forever.
But apparently not for much longer. They sat us down the other night. My dad is moving out. They're getting a divorce.
I'm sorry.
I opened my arms and Mickey stepped into them, sobbing. It was one of the few times I can recall Mickey crying.
Hey, I said, we're gonna miss the previews.
I wrapped my arm around her shoulder as we walked back to the Falcon. Mickey wiped her tears from her cheeks, and I opened the passenger door for her and closed it after she slid in, making my way around to the driver's side.
She likes you, Sam, Mickey said when I climbed behind the wheel.
You hardly talk to her.
I can tell, she said. Be careful.
About what?
Just be careful.
In hindsight, I know that Mickey's concern wasn't that Donna liked me. She couldn't say it then, but what she was contemplating was something I knew intuitively but refused to consider. Why someone like Donna would like someone like me. I had never even been on a date, and now this 18-year-old was sticking her tongue down my throat. Odd as it sounds for a guy who should have been sensitive to such things, I was blinded by the raw hope that maybe, just maybe, Donna did like me, despite the color of my eyes. She had, after all, kissed me, hadn't she? That had to have meant something, didn't it? And why couldn't she like me? I wasn't bad to look at, putting aside the whole eye thing for a moment. I was smart, and I could be funny, at times. But I was being naive. I didn't know it then, but I soon would. Mickey remained pressed against the passenger door. Slide over, will you? Feels strange having you way over there. Mickey picked up the bag of candy and slid over, pressing up against me so hard, the armrest on the door dug into my side. She did spend much of the movie nearly in my lap, but rather than being annoyed, I savored it. Mickey was like Ernie. She had always been there for me when I needed her, and it felt good to be there for her when she needed me. We were misfits, the three of us. I didn't think of us that way back then, but looking back, I know now it was why we gravitated to one another. After the movie, I drove Mickey home, parking the Falcon beneath the outstretched limbs and full leaves of a gnarled, 100-year-old oak tree in her front yard. She didn't immediately get out. She sat staring at the front door of her family's two-story stucco home.
Are you going to be all right? I asked.
Yeah, she said. I'll be fine.
I'll be home after I run deliveries, if you want to talk.
I have a date, she said.
Call me later?
She nodded. Then she did something she'd never done. She leaned over and kissed me on the cheek. I love you, Hill. But, as always, Mickey was out the door and up her driveway before I had the chance to respond. I watched her until she disappeared into her home. I love you too, I said.
16.
Donna sounded as friendly as ever when I entered the store after dropping Mickey at home.
How was the movie? She asked.
Good, I said, still preoccupied by Mickey's deteriorating family situation.
Was Mickey scared?
She's tougher than she lets on. I dust mopped and stocked the shelves while my dad got the deliveries ready. I contemplated telling him what Mickey had told me about her parents getting a divorce, then thought it would break her confidence and decided not to. I wonder if that's what Mickey and my mother talked about in their hushed whispers when I wasn't around. I felt sad for Mickey and for her sister, Joanna, who was still just a kid. Mickey's brothers were older, and from what I could tell, didn't have a lot on the ball. I was naive, I know. My parents weren't perfect. They argued on occasion, and there were times I'd get home, and the chill in the house would be palpable. My mother also thought my father was a little too wed to his Manhattan each night, and said that it set a bad example for me. I'd heard him tell her she was a bit too zealous when it came to religion. Still, I never even contemplated my parents divorcing.